Whoa. Actually, I'm incredibly nervous, which is very strange. excuse me? What I'd like to say is being here after, more than 20 years is an amazing and actually a terrifying thing right now. So I just want to put that out that I'm nervous right now, and what I'd like to be able to do is offer you some guidance towards death and dying. We had a really nice retreat with amazing people this weekend, and it takes a lot of courage to come to a retreat that is about death and dying. Most of us, I think, don't want to go there and don't want to touch it, and culturally, we don't want to touch it either. So just to put yourself in the place of maybe confronting that fear, kudos to everybody who came. And my nervousness also is, I left here about over 20 years ago to pursue a career in chaplaincy and working with sickness, old age, and death, very much what we talk about in Buddhism. And I wanted to make the practice real for myself. And for the last 20-ish years, I've been doing just that. And I'm really grateful for that opportunity and going back over 20 years for the teachings from this monastery. It's very emotional for me. So I hope I get through this talk. Daidoshi, I think he's been dead for over 8 or 9 years now. He's very much alive for me. He was pretty much the only Buddhist teacher I ever had. And I changed my life because of this practice. I was very much questioning at that point, first coming here, who I was, you know, what's the truth, what's this all about, and not feeling very good about the world I was in. And Daidoshi took me on, and I mean it in that way. I don't think I was an easy monk to work with. I had lots of questions, and I guess I was rebellious is my natural nature, which did me well in my life. But to go back to death and dying, because I wanted to be able to tie this all together, one of the first miscellaneous koans, those are like the koans you get before you start working on all the koans. A koan is, for those of you who don't know, it's really something you chew on and you digest. And as far as I'm concerned, you could take one koan where you get stuck and use that for the rest of your life. Because basically, it's where you're going to get stuck again and again in a spiraling evolutionary way. But there's 700 or so koans, so eventually you will find that same one and get stuck again and keep maturing and keep evolving, keep growing. So the first one that really got me in the miscellaneous koans was Daido saying, present Jinpu dead. You know, he would present Jinpu dead. And I was like, okay, sure. That one's easy, you know. I can definitely do that one. And without giving anything away, as a kid, I've played that part. You know, I've cops and robbers and we've all done it. We've all played dead. Playing dead was like, okay, I can do dead, you know. So I came into Dokusan and, boing, and laid on the floor, being dead, right? And thought, is he gonna buy this? You know? is this gonna work? And I remember opening one of my eyes, and he was looking right at me, and he said, not dead yet. And it was like, you know, and then you flip into your brain, okay, so that didn't work. What do I do now? And I went back sitting, and you'd sit, and you sit, and you toss around all the possible, what's he looking for? You know, what could I do to pass this koan? And I did a whole bunch of things. You know, I don't have to go into them, but I pretty much ran the gamut of things I could come up with, right? And to the point, and this is sort of pathetic, but I'll put that out to everybody, to the point of I hyperventilated in there and actually fainted. So then again, I come out of it, and he's just standing there. He goes, not quite dead again. And I was like, and now all these feelings of like, I'll never get this. I don't get what he's at. Why doesn't he tell me, you know, discuss it with me. What's he trying to get? I can do anything he's trying to get me to get. I get it, you know. And just going through all that. And then I sat, and we were doing a session. And it's not like I came up with any answer. But what I realized was I've been playing this. You know, I've been play-acting this. It's like skirting around the outside of things. And we do that. You know, we don't want to touch the thing, the block or the resistance that actually, if we could, will give us our humanity in its completeness. But we don't want to go there. And that's, I think, the real importance of a teacher is to keep pointing or keep guiding or keep kicking your butt until you stop fooling around and you start to really sit. And this practice to me is about getting real, you know. And the workshop that I offer, I try to present it so it becomes a little more real. Obviously, you know, bang, we're not going to pretend we're dead. But you get a little closer in the reality of how much we resist touching that. You know, resist touching sickness, big time. Resist touching aging. And resist touching dying. And it is part of our human life cycle. You know, we are all going to die. And we hear it over and over again. We go, that's right, I know that. I know I'm going to die. Yeah, I've seen, you know, I've seen that happen to others. But we don't make it our own. And until that happens, I don't think we can go as deep as we're able to in our zazen or sitting practice or in our whatever practice you have. It's almost like a necessity to I was going to use confront, but it's not that, to receive what's already there, you know, to receive part of the, part of our humanity so big. I mean, we don't object to being born, some of us do, but being born just sort of happens. But when it comes to death, we go, you know, fight it or do something. It's like this terrible horror coming our way, and we'll do anything not to step into it. Hold on, my lips are dry. So I wanted to share a little about my journey with the real part of what I could touch with death before coming here. I was a dancer, a professional ballet dancer, and during that time, I'm in my 60s now, so during the time when AIDS was a big thing. And a lot of dancers, especially male dancers, were getting AIDS. And I was on the scene for a lot of my best friends dying. And being there, watching the skin, you know, flake from their body and watching them wither away and watching the only thing left is the heartbeat, you know, pounding out of their chest as a skull starts to appear on their face. And it made it real. And I think, in a way, that's what brought me to practice in the first place. It's like, wow, that will happen to me too. You know, it made it that close. It was like, wait, this is not only happening to my best friends. Even if I don't have AIDS, it's still going to happen to me. And, you know, it's wonderful they have the cocktail now and people don't have to go through that. It was one of the worst deaths, and I've seen lots of deaths at this point being a chaplain, but I've never experienced that kind of flesh decaying kind of thing that happens with AIDS. I'm sure there are other diseases that are just as horrible. So that was like the first big make it real for me. Actually, before that, when I was a kid, when I went to sleep and I was worried about things, my mother would tell me, we come from a religious background in Judaism, and she would say, well, say this, and, you know, I'd sit and put my hands together in prayer, and I'd go, you know, and I'm sure you've all heard it, you know, now I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. And I had trouble sleeping after that. It made in my imagination, it made it, oh my God, you know, God's going to come and grab me when I close my eyes and In my sense of being a kid, die, you know, disappear. And what if he doesn't? You know, what if I do die and he doesn't come for me, you know? Did I do something wrong? Was I, you know, it's all of that stuff that we get, I was going to say, impregnated with. It came up in the workshop weekend about people asking about certain religious things of their past. It connected me to that in my past, because so many of the religions are fantastic in their birth, you know, and how they came to be, but then the institutions of them make it so that fear is used as a tool. I don't want to be more specific in that, but let's just say heaven and hell. Right, that a lot of children grow up still today with, you know, don't do that or you'll go to hell, you know, or you better come into the group or you're going to go to hell. Or, you know, as a chaplain, I've come across that so many times when a Catholic patient needs last rites, and it is so important to get a priest for that. Last rite or blessings of blessing of the sick. You know, it's changed so it makes it more available, so you don't have to be right at the last breath, because they don't have enough priests to be in the hospitals to do that. And yet the part of it that they've made so important. I mean, imagine if you grew up that way and the importance of being blessed in that way so that you don't go to hell. It takes my breath away, you know, and I've seen so many patients fall through the crack dying because we just don't have the priests to do that anymore. And it's like, even when you call a priest, if you're on call, it's very hard to get somebody, and I don't blame them. It's a very difficult thing these days. You know, it's the systems are breaking down. And but the power of that teaching is still so present, you know. And I can talk about other religions and similar things, and I can even talk about Buddhism and how sometimes the tightness of it can scare a lot of people from, let's say, even sitting, because maybe your knees hurt and you'd like to understand stillness in your life, or you'd like to feel what silence would be, but it's too painful. All you're dealing with is the pain, and that's okay. You can deal with the pain to a degree, but if it's the only thing, then you're not getting what's possible in the whole, you know? So we all have it. We all have places in our particular religions where it stops a person from pursuing what the religion was originally intended to do. And, you know, I guess there's nothing to do about that, but at least be aware, whatever religion you're in, go for what why you started to ask in the first place. You know, what is it you want from your particular religion? And any religion can offer you, you know, centered prayer is an incredible, powerful way of centering yourself, very much like meditation practices, or Hinduism with repeated mantra. You know, it stops the thinking mind from going, you know, channel surfing, because you're constantly refocusing it, like we do here with counting the breath. You see a thought, you let it go, you go back to the count of one. So it's a focusing agent that can keep you on target in a way. So what was I talking about? Okay, going into being present for people dying. The next big death that I had to be present for. Well, before that happened, I was married for 27 years. And way before my husband got sick, he eventually died almost the time of when Dido died, like a year before Dido, she died. So it was like a double whammy for me when that happened. But before he got sick, before he was diagnosed, he woke up one night and we slept together, and I remember him waking up in terror, you know. He was like, I've never seen him like that, like shaking, and his eyes like, you know, totally wondering what's going on. And I kept trying to get him to talk, but he was in terror, you know. And I said, what's going on? What's going on? Talk to me. And for a while, he just couldn't. He was just like, and then when he finally started to talk, he said he didn't understand it, but it was like coming to the edge of his life, you know, and almost like falling into something else. And he said it scared, I'm not going to use the bad words, but he used them all, you know. It scared him really badly. And he never forgot that. So when he was finally diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, at the end, we didn't know it till it was stage 4, which is not good for those of you who, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, and 4 is like, you can say goodbye. He put up a barrier, to anything involved with looking at his death. And here I was already a chaplain many years, and wanting to go with him, walk with him as he was dying. I wanted to be there. You know, intimacy is a big thing with me, you know. And I love my husband. He was the best partner, you know, ever, ever, ever. I wanted to walk with him in dying. And it was just like, boom. And it was because of that one time when he almost touched it. And I knew that, and I couldn't change the fact that he wanted me to jump in to refusing it to. And at first I couldn't, you know. He looked in my eyes and he saw, you know, the doctor gave him 3 months. And when you get that diagnosis, usually you can cut that in half. You know, they're trying to make it better for you in a way. So I knew that. I worked at Memorial Sloan Kettering, so I knew all about cancer and all about chemo and all about the drugs possible and the poisons possible. Honestly, I would never do it for myself, but here he was jumping into wanting to survive. And here I was going, let's talk about what's happening now. And the more I did that, and the more he looked into my eyes, the more he pushed me away at that point. And that was wrenching. You know, someone else in the workshop, we talked about wrenching. You know, it's wrenching. You know, I think even in Judaism, they tear their shirt. It's that kind of a feeling. You tear your breast open, you know. And I was like crying every night, and my sister finally almost slapped my face. I was at the door, and she came over, and she said, you always tell me you're supposed to join people. Why aren't you doing that with him, you know? And it was just like, oh, of course. You know, I'm trying to get him to be real in the way I want him to be real, but I was refusing to let him show me his journey, how he wanted to journey into his death. Whoa. And that was after doing chaplaincy for, you know, more than 10 years. That hit me like a bombshell. So I offer everybody here that one. You join the path of the other. If you love that person, don't try to change them. If you want to walk with them, walk with them. Don't try to impose your knowledge or your way or your, you know, To this day, I thought I was correct in not wanting chemo for him, but he actually lived 2.5 years with his survival skill of being defensive, you know. So there, you know. So lesson for me, pretty incredible. So those things make up our lives, you know, those truths that we live, not the thinking part, you know. Okay, let's see, how do I want to die? You know, it's the reality parts of our lives that make us who we are, I think. So that was a big one. The other big one, and it has stayed with me and taught me, my patients taught me almost everything I know about sickness, old age, and death. I mean, I sat for 12 years as a resident here, but it never hit me so deeply as being in front of somebody who's sick, aging, and dying. You know, it's a very, very different thing. But I couldn't do what I'm doing. I couldn't do what I did there without this foundation. You know, so they work together somehow. And I guess each of us has to figure out how we want that to work together in our life. But you know, lay practice and monastic practice, they've been separated. They aren't separate. You know, even if you're a monastic, especially here, you're working with people constantly. It used to drive me crazy, you know. Seriously. I feel, you know, I'm in a way a super introvert, I think, on the scales of Myers-Briggs. And I wanted to just sit forever and ever and ever and disappear, you know, more like Hinayana than Mahayana at that point. This practice just stopped that from happening. In Daido, she stopped that from happening. And so this one patient, she was a woman in her 90s, and she was alone. All her friends had died. I'd been with her once before, and I really liked her. She was on her... It was like the last day for her, and the nurses liked her too. And they referred me to her to sit. They told me to come right away. They thought she was they're actively dying. Instead of we're all just dying, they were actively dying, do you know? So I go in there, and she recognizes me, and she's got the face my husband had, you know, terror. It was like she was already sort of sunken from the disease, and her eyeballs were like screaming, reaching. You know, it's like, what's that painter? Yeah, you know, on the bridge, it's the scream, right? Well, it was a living painting. You know, she was really living that scream. And I took her hand, I reached for her hand, and she grabbed me. She sat up, and she didn't have that much strength, I thought. She sat up, and she grabbed my body, pulled me with the power of 12 people to her until we were like eyeball to eyeball. And I'm like, now I'm in terror. It's like, I was like shaking. I get hairs on the back of my head. But I was like, I was in fight or flight. You know, it's like, oh no, you can die, but not me, you know? I mean, it's like, I'm out of here. Let me go. And I was fighting to be released from the grip, you know, really fighting for my life. I mean, it's the best way I can explain it. I was fighting for my life. I wanted out. She wanted to take me with her into death. You know, I knew that. And my survival instincts as a human being were active. I've never felt that way before, you know. And I couldn't remove myself from the grip. So we're eyeball to eyeball, you know, like this. And she's like looking at me like this, and I'm like terrified and wanting to get away. And then all of a sudden, it's like I stopped fighting. And if you could ask me why that happened, I don't know. You know, I really don't know. But at some point, I knew it was useless trying to get away from that grip. And I stopped fighting, and I relaxed, you know. I just relaxed into, quote unquote, the moment. Right? And because I did, she relaxed. And both of us didn't grab each other anymore, but we still were right there. And I was like, I was willing to go anywhere with her at that moment, you know. You want to take me to death? Take me. And there was such a power of, you know, it's love. It's love, but not love. You know, it's the energy of all accepting. It's energy of all surrendering. But that's after the fact, you know. All of these words are after the fact of the actual. It was the most love I've ever felt in my life. And I've felt lots of different kinds of love. But that one, that was total, you know, total. And that stays with me, makes me who I am for the rest of my life on this planet. You know, it informs us. All these things inform us. So again, you know, I'm starting to live a life of gratitude because it's like, oh my God, I can't believe it. You know, it's like all these things are given, I feel, given to me. And gee, you know, and if you can think back in your life, there's so many millions of those things that if we can just relax and go, this is a miracle that I'm even sitting here. In my mind, this is a miracle. Because I never thought this was going to happen. And also seeing, Yukon Grody, I call him Grodsky, you know, officiate, that's like a miracle. It was wonderful, a wonderful miracle, you know. I mean, he's great, you know. And all, you know, I'm the next generation that's aging and going to die, you know. And it's just very interesting to you know, to be part of a spiral, you know. It's almost like I'm not like the prodigal daughter. I haven't come home, but I've never left. Do you know, it's a whole different thing. It's part of who I am. This is part of who I am. So is a lot of other things, and all my patients are, you know, it's all part of who I am. I guess that's what I learned in chaplaincy was, you know, at first it's the other, the patient. You know, you go see the patient in room 107, and you go, oh, it's Jenny in 107, and she's got this kind of problem, and hospitals are terrible about stripping you of your identity. You know, I don't like that part. So you're given, you know, a band and a number and all this stuff, and go see Jenny in room 101 with this diagnosis. And at first you come in, or, you know, I have a badge, it says chaplain. So you come in some kind of authority way, and you do your introductions, but there's some point, I call it the ET moment, you know, when you and the other stop separating so great, you know, so such make such a big deal of it, you know, your ego and their ego isn't that important anymore, and you really want to know who that person is, and they've let you in, you know, they've let you into their life and their suffering, their illness, old age, and death, and it's like, wow, I get the opportunity to live your life, you know, to in some way feel what you're going through. That's amazing, you know. So the person you're looking at, I'd say, is the thousands and thousands of patients. You're looking at all of them when you're looking at me. And I am grateful to be able to say that. You know, I'm grateful to be able to say that. And it's been an incredible path, and I recommend it for anyone who's interested. Okay, I promised a workshop participant that I'd talk a little about, make it easy for them to understand Buddhism. So the easiest way that I know is, and a lot of different religions use this in some way about the ocean and the wave. And it's so simple that it's profound. So I'm going to offer it out. If you think of God or the Absolute or everything you could possibly imagine as ocean, right? Totally enveloping everything. And then imagine that out of this ocean comes a wave. And the wave, you know, we went through, in the workshop, we went through different ages of our life. You know, look in the mirror and see what it's like when you're born. Look in the mirror and see what it's like when you're 5, when you're 10, when you're 20, when you're 30. And keep going, even if you were 20 years old, we keep going. Look in the mirror and see what it's like when you're 100. You know, it's like, it's almost startling to see people's reactions because it's like, wow, I am totally, this frame has changed so many millions of times, and yet I keep saying, this is Trudy, you know, this is Jinpu, right? I mean, I don't even recognize some of my photos when I was a kid. People have told me, that's you. Okay, you know, not so sure. I mean, I don't have a connection to it more than that's my photo when I was 5, playing with my doll, you know. Okay. You know, so again, so the wave starts to appear. And as the wave comes up from the ocean, it's still very connected. So let's say you're a very, very young child and you're still not separated. You know, you haven't formed your quote unquote ego frame yet. So you're still knowing that you're ocean, right? You're still knowing that this wave is the ocean. We're calling it wave because it looks a little different. It looks like a ripple or a wave, or it looks like you know, a big bubble or seltzer or who knows what you got going there. But it's from the ocean, is the ocean, always will be the ocean. But what happens with all of us is at some point, when we form enough, when we get that wave settled enough, we go, I ain't the ocean. I'm me. This is me. And I'm going to make me strong. I'm going to make me rich. I'm going to make me happy. I'm going to make me, you know, it's like great for the selfie generation, right? It's they so distinct in their wave that it's very hard to remember that if you just relax, if you just let go, and I don't mean you can't forcibly let go, but if you just exhale, let's say, you're back to being the whole. You're back to being the ocean. And you never were. You didn't even have to go back. You know, you were never other than that. But you have the play and the miracle of playing out your way in this particular life. And when you die, you're forced, if you have to be forced, into that realization again. But why so sad? You know, I mean, what's going on? Why are we so sad? We're sad because we grieve. The people who are alive grieve the loss of that particular wave in their life that they're used to, that they loved, that they whatever. But again, and that's where sitting is amazing, because that's all sitting is about. It's about first dealing with your fear of letting that wave exhale out. You know, first we deal with that, and then we're dealing with the resistance of, wait, if I let the wave out, will I ever come back again as me? You know, will it change me? Will I not even recognize me if I do come back? I don't want to let go. I don't want to exhale out. And also, then I'm like everybody else, you know? I mean, we have so many ways to stop the wave from remembering, you know? It's all like, why are we working so hard? I swear, it's not a bad thing, you know? Death is not this bad thing. We have created it to be bad because we feel we lose out, or our friends or family lose out. But you have it all, you know? You are it all. So where's the losing out if you let go? You know, not, I don't like that word. I'm going to find a better way to say that, because it's not like, oh, I'll take this off and take that off. And we do that too. We keep thinking we're going to peel the onion until it's going to happen. You know, it's going to happen. We play games, lots and lots. I did, you know, so I'm talking about myself, and I'm sure I'm talking about a lot of people here. Until we stop playing games. It's incredible, right? I mean, if you can be your wave, be your unique self, it's really amazing. But never forget, you are ocean, you know? I mean, these are all words trying to explain something, so I hope that helps. But to me, that is Buddhism 101. Okay, I guess I should start. But I don't get this opportunity. Okay, death and immortality. I tore this out of one of my favorite books, which is the Hermetica, which is a ancient Egypt Hermes Trismegistus. You know, once you do the ocean wave thing, you start seeing it everywhere. You know, every religion has it showing up as a wave somewhere. You know, you can catch that wave. I just like this. I think it, and I'll close with this. I'll stop after this. For man, time is a destroyer. But for the cosmos, you know, let's say ocean, It is an ever-turning wheel. It is ever-turning waves, right? I'm just trying to make this. These earthly forms, these waves, that come and go are illusions. How can something be real which never stays the same? Right? We just want to make it, grab it. But these transitory illusory things arise from the underlying permanent reality. They all arise from the ocean. All these waves arise from the ocean. Birth is not the beginning of life, right? Wave. Only of an individual awareness, only of a particular unique wave, right? Seen through that wave's eyes, perceptions. Change into another state is not death. Okay, the wave changes, maybe comes up again. Only the ending of that particular awareness, that particular perception through that wave. Most people are ignorant of the truth and therefore afraid of death. And it's back to Buddhism saying we cling. You know, clinging is suffering. It doesn't get more simple than that. You know, whatever we cling to is going to make us suffer because we have to separate to cling. As long as I'm ocean, I can play as a wave, this wave or that wave, as much as I want. But as soon as I grab, I'm going to suffer because somebody's going to take this book away. And then I deal with grief and loss. And I feel like, I'm missing my book. Believing it to be the greatest of all evils. Most people are ignorant of the truth and therefore afraid of death, believing it to be the greatest of all evils. Right? But death is only the dissolution of a worn-out body. Dissolution of a wave. So that's about all I'll ever have to say. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. The monastery's quarterly journal, Mountain Record, has a new home at mountainrecord.org. For over 30 years, Mountain Record has been offering spiritual seekers of all faiths a unique journey through words and images. Each quarterly issue delivers a thought-provoking array of classic teachings, contemporary wisdom, stunning photographs, and news from the Mountains and Rivers Order. For more information, to subscribe, or to read our open access articles, visit mountainrecord.org.